Welcome to Subject Blackout. My name is Timo. With me, as always, is Mike. Mike, how you doing?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing well. With the wrapping up of the Beijing Winter Olympic Games, we decided that we were going to take a look at a Winter Olympic Games classic. That one, of course, is Disney's 1993 movie, Cool Runnings.
Quick, name some other Winter Olympic classics.
Balto.
There's an Nancy Kerrigan movie, but technically it's just focused on ice skating.
On Tanya Harding, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I, Tanya. Okay. Yeah. That doesn't count. Okay. Other Olympic movies. Is this the only Olympic movie?
Oh, I don't know about only Olympic movie. Maybe Winter Olympic, though.
Okay. Name a Summer Olympic movie.
Chariots of Fire.
Damn it. Is that? Yeah.
Suck my dick.
Yep. All right.
But yeah, there are few and far between in any Winter Olympic movies. Let's just do a quick Google search.
We could have talked about this. We could have prepared this earlier. We didn't.
I didn't know you were going to do that. Oh, there's Eddie the Eagle. That came out a couple years ago.
Don't know that one.
Taron Egerton, the guy from Kingsman. He plays
Elton John. That guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He plays Eddie the Eagle, who is an English ski jumper from the 70s who didn't know what he was doing. And that was why everyone fell in love with him.
Sure.
And he finished last. Much like this story.
Much like this movie. Yeah. That's it. Same plot.
I don't know what the cutting edge is, but
it's gotta be about skating. I think it's about skating.
It appears to be about ice hockey. Of course, there is Miracle, which is about the 1980s. Oh,
of course.
Game.
Yeah. That's a great movie.
It's a really good movie. Foxcatcher is not Winter Olympic, but it is an Olympic movie. As we said, Itania. They have Blades of Glory here.
Not sure that counts.
It's an ice skating movie, that's for sure.
It's a winter sport movie.
You know, it's the darkest Olympic movie.
Ooh. Blade Runner. What is it?
Munich.
Oh, ooh, yeah, that is.
It's a very good movie. I would love to watch that again sometime soon because I haven't seen that in forever. But
I love that we found a way to create a list of movies that include Munich, Cool Runnings, Blades of Glory, and other sports movies.
You know, Miracle, Blades of Glory, Munich.
Munich.
All the same genre of film.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few more here, but it's
much more serious role for John Candy, Munich.
Yeah.
There's, sure wasn't like Uncle Buck, I'll tell you that.
There's on this list that I found more just winter sports. Your slap shots. Some skating movies. But yeah, no, as far as Olympic movies go, there are few of them, and Cool Runnings is one of the most famous, if not the most famous, adaptation of an Olympic story. So, Mike, given that we have just wrapped up the Olympics and we were feeling in the Olympic spirit, how did Cool Runnings hit you watching it in the year of our Lord 2022?
Yeah, I mean, I remember this movie from our childhood in the 90s. I remember watching it a couple times, and it was, I enjoyed it. I mean, it was fine. I think it was fine. There's a few things that I do want to talk about. Like, I tried to find an angle that I thought would be sort of interesting to approach this from. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call this John Candy's most iconic. I mean, he's very well known in this role, but I don't think this sort of represents the type of comedic range that John Candy typically has. A movie like Uncle Buck, I think, is much more.
That. I was going to say, yeah, this is a much more ornery role for him.
Yes. So I guess that's kind of interesting. So this was his last movie before his death. Although I learned this because I also watched this movie, which is going to be an interesting point of comparison. But he was in talks at the time while he was filming this to be part of Pocahontas as a turkey who would have been the third animal companion called Red Feather. And his role would have just been there to break the tension.
Well, and some things are lost to time, and it's truly a tragedy.
So, unfortunately, they had to write out the the comedic character from Pocahontas.
It's a damn shame.
So it was interesting to watch this movie like several days ago, and then actually we're going back through the Disney Renaissance to try and figure out who is the most evil villain and which musical has the best songs. So we did Pocahontas. So I don't know if you've gone back to that movie.
I have.
A little racist. Pretty perfect for Mel Gibson, who's in there, but
I did not know that.
Cool Runnings, not racist, but certainly racial. Racial.
Now I agree. Mm. But when the movie opens, and within the first 10 minutes, you get a character named Sanka Coffee. And you get a character named Yul Brynner. I was very concerned about the tone of this movie, and maybe, since the last time I'd watched it, the world had changed too much.
Right. Like Pocahontas, where it's like... So there are ways... Because I looked this up. So the actual story that they're adapting...
Yes. So different from what actually happened.
Right. There's a little bit more... In some cases, there's a little bit more agency given to the Jamaican bobsled team in the movie than was present in real life. Like, as an example, the movie, a major plot point is finding the funding, right? To actually fund. They need $20,000. They're doing, like, all this stuff on the street. They're, like, singing on the street and stuff. And it's all, like, kind of funny or whatever.
They're crowdfunding before crowdfunding.
Right. But the entire time... In real life, this was kind of engineered by two Americans in conjunction with the Jamaican tourist industry. So there was never any concern about there being money available. But the whole thing about like finding athletes who didn't make it into the Summer Olympics as runners, that was a pretty true part of the whole thing.
Well,
so
yeah. I also read that instead of just looking for failed summer athletes, which is how this movie goes about it.
Right.
Is they were basically looking at the Jamaican military and going, here's our recruiting zone, unbelievably fit, disciplined Jamaicans. And I thought that was a very funny contrast from what Disney brings you, which is just like, one of them's a fun-loving, crazy guy, and the other three are these great track stars. And it's like, no, this is not. Yeah. These are all military veterans.
Yeah, and in real life, they were using military bases to train and do kind of like running drills, but they were also using like refrigeration rooms and things to prepare for just being in cold weather and stuff. So like the original story is actually kind of interesting in itself. Mm-hmm. But I do think there were opportunities to make the translation onto film, especially for like 93?
Yeah.
There were opportunities, again, Pocahontas was 96. There were opportunities to make this way more racist. And I think that the way the movie tries to position the bobsledders themselves is it does make them the star of the show. They're the ones that are like finding the funding. They're the ones that are assembling the team. Like, so I think that's good. I think that it sort of leads with the bobsledders in a way that you might not have expected. You might have expected them to like lean heavily on John Candy just to kind of prop everybody up.
Well, and you talked about finding an angle to talk about this movie in the modern world.
Yeah.
And one of the things I thought about after watching it was, hey, I thought it was good. It was funnier than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
But then I came across like the thought, is John Candy a white savior in this film?
That's a good question. I was thinking about that too.
And I came down on the side of, he is not a white savior.
Right.
He doesn't want to participate in this until he's convinced that he can right a wrong for himself. That's a key point, is he's not doing this to save these gentlemen. He's doing this because he failed an old friend, and this is his chance to repay his debt to his son. Another aspect is the reason they get a white man is because John Candy has institutional knowledge about a Winter right. Olympic sport,
Canadian.
Which just can't happen in Jamaica.
Right.
Just there's no way for them to naturally come across bobsledding. So I think those are the main 2 points where I think Disney flirts with at times this white savior in yep. this movie, but I think it firmly comes down on the side of no, there are specific reasons for why this man is doing this that has nothing to do with a pity or support for, you know, an impoverished nation or the people within it. And also because I think it's clear that the characters pushing forward the story and making all of the important decisions are the Jamaican bobsled team.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the counter argument, like, I think I agree with you. There's the counter argument is that at one point in the movie, the opportunity to compete is entirely out of the hands of the bobsledders, despite having qualified. And it comes down to John Candy to sort of fix the situation. So, but he's not being positioned as a white savior the entire time. There sort of is a moment where he kind of, I think in the way that you're saying, has to sort of confront and absolve himself of his own past. And that becomes like a pivotal way that the Jamaican bobsledders can actually compete.
Yeah, he doesn't, in that particular scene where he is arguing against his former teammate, Kurt, who Kurt you'll recognize as the father from Walk Hard.
Yeah.
Which I've seen this movie dozens of times when I was a kid. Forgot I loved it. But yeah,
yeah, you're right.
I was like, wait a second, is that the dad from Walk Hard? And sure enough, it is. So yeah, no, when he goes in and makes that speech, again, that speech isn't about like, I mean, he does literally say like, let my boys ride or whatever, but it's not about, he knows that the problem that the international community has is with him and he's the problem.
Yeah.
Not anything the Jamaicans are doing. So again, it flirts that line with white savior, but I think this movie holds up and, or at least that plot line holds up as something that is not really problematic. It just sort of kind of makes sense.
So like plot wise, I feel like this is a type of movie that structurally really didn't make it out of the 90s, but it's a yeah. particular type of underdog narrative. And the movie that I kept coming back to, honestly, like hear me out on this, but was Tommy Boy.
Okay.
So you kind of have, small town charisma and ingenuity and intuition up against sort of like a much larger kind of like powerhouse that has experience and resources behind them. But your pluckiness and your scrappiness and the fact that you have like a vibrant town that has your back sort of drives you to a point of success. So I think there, that was a particular type of 90s sort of underdog story that I don't really feel like kind of made its way out of that era. But movies like Tommy Boy, Black Sheep, which is basically also Tommy
it's,
Boy.
It's just Tommy Boy again.
Beverly Hills Ninja. All Chris Farley movies. All like Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
And
you know who's kind of like Chris Farley?
John Candy.
You're right.
Yep. There's a connection.
Yeah, no, I definitely see
that. Because they're fat.
Yeah, and white.
And funny. And dead.
Yep.
Ooh. Spoiler.
Well, that just stopped the bud dead in its tracks. No, but yeah, I think what you said, Tommy Boy, and that's a funny movie to compare this to, because it is very much, not that it's like horribly crude, but it's very much not a Disney movie.
Right.
And it's very much not a sports movie. And sports movies usually work in a very specific formula.
Yeah, so that was my next question for you, because you're more of a sports movie person. We talked about this when we watched
Fast and the Furious, I believe.
Tokyo Drift, right, which you thought of more of as a sports movie than as like a car movie. So how does this stand up as a sports movie?
So some of the key things in my mind to what a sports movie is... either fish out of water or scrappy underdog. We got both. then you have to have key training montage sequences.
Sure.
Absolutely have those.
Yep.
You almost always have those training sequences overlooked by an outsider who has come usually reluctantly to help out.
Yep.
Yes, we have that. Absolutely. And usually you win in the end. That's why these movies usually get made, because the 1980 men's Olympic hockey team beats Russia, or right. it's, you know, because it turns out white men can jump. there's usually a reason for these movies, and it's just like a feel-good story for the sporting team or person to overcome these obstacles that were set in the beginning and accomplish all of their dreams at the end. So how this movie sets it up is that they want to go to the Olympics. So they're willing to do anything. These three sprinters and Sanka are willing to do anything to get to the Olympics. And we get to the Olympics with like 45 minutes left in the movie. Now, for the next 15 to 20 minutes of the movie, it's will they qualify for the Olympics? So there's that. But still, we're not at the end of the movie, and they've kind of accomplished their dream. And so then what happens is the movie goes, hey, maybe they could win Olympic gold or place on the podium.
Right.
And that was in no way a possibility in the real story. So no. We'll just ignore that.
Yes. In real life, yeah, they came in last.
They were doing very poorly, and then they crashed in their third of four runs.
They did. They also crash in the movie. The crash in real life was due to human error. Crash yes. in the movie, it was sort of like implied that it was
yeah.
like kind of like a rickety old bobsled, which is like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really need that. You can just give me that they were trying to push it to the limit and, you know, they missed an edge and
yeah.
whatever. But yeah, they, without ever referencing it, they just implied like, oh, it wasn't their fault.
Just, right.
Like, kind of demurs it. But one of the things they do with that speech to Kurt from John Candy late, and especially the speech in between Leon Robinson's Derek Banner, or Bannock, I should say, and John Candy, is that he reminds him, it's like, hey, I fucked up because my whole life is about winning. And when it's about winning, not winning is not acceptable. And
right.
And if you aren't good enough without it, you'll never be good enough with it. And so it kind of reframes the movie in the last little bit. So instead of winning gold, it's crossing that finish line that proves that the Jamaicans deserve to be there. And that's why you get the greatest slow clap of all time.
Yes.
in any movie. There are 32 seconds between the first clap and the second clap. And it's amazing. But no, as a sports movie, I think it's fairly prototypical. They do a little bit of rejiggering at the end because they realize that they can't just give them the gold medal because that didn't happen. but yeah, it's pretty bog standard sports movie fodder. It's highly entertaining. I still very much a lot of it is because of my childhood, but I still very much have a tender spot in my heart for this movie.
You know, I mean, just to introduce real life and ruin the narrative a little bit more, but in the 1988 Olympics in Calgary, there were actually two other bobsled teams from the Caribbean.
Yes.
And, but something a little bit more interesting, I guess, is there was still a Jamaican bobsled team in the 2020 Olympics. They were not the worst team. They didn't win. But
they were not the worst.
But they were not the worst team.
They've appeared in several Olympics since 1988.
Yep.
Not every 4 years, no. But they were in this past Olympics. And yeah, they think they qualified in 2020 and 2016 too, maybe.
Yep.
Whenever it was. So they've had moderate success. I mean, you have to be one of the top 30 nations in the world at it. And I don't know if you know this, but the four-man bobsled team wasn't the only Jamaican team to compete in bobsled at the event. The original intention was to have a team qualify for the two-man. And they qualified and ran for the two-man.
They did.
And
they did a lot better, actually.
They did so well. They're like, hey, let's try and qualify for the four-man. Yeah. And they did, and that's probably why they were a little underprepared and right. crashed in the third out of four runs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this was a deliberate plan by the Jamaican Olympic Committee. For whatever reason, whether it was to build nationalistic pride or to just try to push boundaries with their Olympic Committee, mm-hmm. whether it was they just had extra funds and were like, I don't know, this seems like a good idea. Whatever it was, this was not the scrappy feel-good plan that the movie seems to make it out as. This is a little bit more cold and calculated, but I mean, still, the Jamaicans look themselves as pretty happy to come out of Calgary 88 with a decent running in their first ever Winter Olympics.
A cool running, if you will.
Wow, we're good. We're getting good at this. Yeah, so overall, I like I said, I think this movie
it was fine.
Holds up.
Yeah.
I do love the part where we learn that Yul Brynner has decided that he's going to live at Buckingham Palace, but right. he doesn't know what Buckingham Palace is.
Right.
And I'm just 1988 was a different time. But how do you not know what the fuck Buckingham Palace looks like?
Especially when you're a former British colony and had just yeah. kind of won your independence probably about like, 20 years before that.
By the type of paper that image is of, he clearly cut that out of a textbook.
Right.
Like, it had a caption underneath it.
Right. Hashtag they knew.
Yeah. Can Yul Brynner not read? And also, why did his parents name him Yul Brynner? That
they like the King
cruel.
And I. They like the Magnificent Seven.
We know our son is going to grow up to be bald. Let's name him Yul Brynner. Yeah, that and Sanka Coffee very early on, I was like, oh boy, I don't know about this. This feels insensitive. But yeah, no, I enjoyed it. All right, Mike, let's take a quick little break here and we'll be right back with more. Next week on Subject to Blackout. Mike and I are both excited to return to theaters to review a film that's actually coming out this year. While the DC Extended Universe has not had any sort of consistency over the past few years, one of the few bright spots in their cinematic history is their ability to find new and interesting ways to tell Batman stories. In this latest version of The Caped Crusader, writer-director Matt Reeves has paired himself with Robert Pattinson, Zoe Kravitz, Paul Dano, Jeffrey Wright, John Turturro, Peter Sarsgaard, Andy Serkis, and Colin Farrell. It's not exactly a murderer's row, but this cast, along with a great trailer, has Mike and me excited to see a DC movie for the first time in some time. We'll be headed to the theater Friday to watch the all-new Batman. So join us next Monday as we review 2022's The Batman. All right, Mike, we're back, and I was just wondering if it's been, you know, a couple of weeks since we last spoke.
Right.
I was wondering if there was any media or stuff that you've been consuming recently. Obviously, you just said that you are in a bit of a Disney rewatch.
Yeah, so going back through the Renaissance, the movies from 1989 to 1999 to figure out who's actually the worst villain. Frollo from The Hunchback is the worst villain.
Now, for the people like myself who are not the biggest Disney enthusiasts,
right?
I'm pretty sure I saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame, but I'm pretty sure I only saw it once. Can you tell me who this character is?
Right. So, yeah, there were a few of those movies that you just watched over and over again, like The Lion King. And there are other ones that are sort of like respected, but you kind of like didn't really spend any time with them. Kind of like the later ones, like Hercules and Hunchback. Like Hunchback was actually pretty dark and like pretty thematically mature as compared to the rest of the movies. But Frollo, who's the main villain, he's a judge who really hates gypsies and is the guy who is keeping Quasimodo sort of sequestered in Notre Dame Cathedral. So whereas like it's really interesting to go back and watch this movie because there's a lot of really honestly dark sexuality about it. Frollo's whole thing is that he wants to fuck gypsies. but he hates gypsies. So he has to kill gypsies so he doesn't fuck them.
That's real dark. That is real dark.
So there's like an actual scene where, like, I swear to you, like, go back and watch this movie, that Esmeralda, the gypsy Disney princess, is kind of being held and interrogated, and Frollo like smells her hair in a really creepy way in a Disney movie.
Is there a non-creepy way to smell hair?
It could just be like, what is that? What do you use?
Is that a scent of poverty upon you?
Is that lavender? So like that. He didn't do it that way. He did it in like, I want to kill you because I want to bang you way. And like it's implied that the whole reason why Quasimodo was orphaned was because Frollo killed his mother for rejecting his advances.
Yikes.
Yeah. So he's actually the worst villain because he's just sort of like driven by a hatred of gypsies and an inability to address his own sexual urges without murder. Whereas Scar just wanted to kill his brother.
Everybody wants to be king.
Yeah. So he's the worst villain for sure. But yeah, I've been watching those. Those have been my main movies. What have you been watching?
So I've been doing some TV recently. I had broken the Apple subscription recently just because they kind of stopped showing stuff. There were a couple movies that came out. There was that Macbeth, which I probably would have watched, but I was like, you know what? One less subscription right now. But then a couple of people on the internet and Twitter and stuff were like, hey, this Severance thing on Apple TV with Adam Scott and Chris Walken, John
Turturro. You're telling me about it. Yeah.
I was like, that's a bunch of names. And they're like, yeah. And it's directed by Zoolander. What's his name?
Ben Drawing Stiller.
Ben Stiller. Thank you.
Merman.
Merman. As a single tear rolls down his face.
I think I'm getting the black lung pop.
I guess I have a lot to ponder.
Oh man, classic.
It's a great movie. No, so I heard all of this, and the basic plot summary is that people who work for this company go through a process called severance, mm-hmm. and it is an implant into their brain that they sign up for.
Sure.
And then they work on a special floor where the implant kicks in, and everything you do at work, you remember only as that work person. And then when you go home, you forget all of those memories and you only remember everything outside of work.
Okay.
So it's sort of science fiction in that manner. And it plays along with, like, it's clearly doing some stuff with dealing with trauma and dealing with memory, identity. The third episode came out this weekend, and I don't know how long the series is. Usually they're like 8 to 10 episodes, but maybe it's shorter or longer. Those are the two options. And so far it's visually very interesting.
Cool.
It's funny in parts, but it is serious as a heart attack in others. So highly recommend that. The only other thing I've been really watching recently is been doing a little bit of a rewatch of Mad Men.
Yeah, man, I love Mad Men.
I haven't watched
that, and I've kind of been scared to get back into it. Not that I won't like it, but I just, like, I don't want to be invested in 7 seasons of like the intensity of that show.
Yeah, it is. It is real intense. There's been a couple episodes where, like, even Don, who's ostensibly the character you're supposed to sympathize most with outside of Peggy, Don does and says these things where you're like, damn, Don, like, you just got home from fucking some strange. You could be nice to your wife, you asshole.
Well, like, that's not his fault. She's super high maintenance.
It's incredible. Some of the things that just get said, you're like, holy shit. Like, it was holy shit when the series came out, because it was like, hey, it used to be like that, and we're not going to shy away from how it used to be. But it gets dark from time to time. It's really, really, it's arresting how different the eras are.
I mean, I like, first of all, that was the series along with Community that introduced us to Alison Brie.
Yeah.
Who I love. Yes. But there's like a handful of the people from that show you've seen in like in other places. But like John Slattery kind of takes like sort of background roles. You kind of see him in weird places. He was what's his name?
Tony Stark's
father. Yeah, and Endgame, you see Pierce, what's his face, in Foundation, which I ruined for you. John Hamm. You don't see John Hamm around anywhere.
No, he does not usually sign up for good movies.
You saw him in like a, yeah, he saw him in like a Black Mirror episode.
Yeah, he was on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which yes. You haven't watched.
Right.
Yeah,
he hasn't been up to anything.
He's just, usually he's like a CIA agent in like a bad thriller that comes out. He gets those kind of roles.
He was in the Wet Hot American Summer prequel.
One of my... Was he? I forget that.
Yeah.
Okay.
As like a CIA guy.
Yeah, of course.
The Falcon.
One of my favorite John Hamm cameos is in the HBO series Barry, where the main character all of a sudden wants to start becoming an actor, and he has these fantasy sequences where you don't realize they're a fantasy until he like snaps out of them. And one of them, John Hamm just like stands up next to him, and then he snaps out of it. Like the show just shows Barry in real life, and Barry's like, oh, hey, John Hamm. He's just talking to himself as though John Hamm were there.
So yeah, John Hamm. But do you know who I think I like? I kind of want to go back and revisit Mad Men just for this actor to see how I feel about his role now, but also to see what else he's done. But like Pete, remember Pete was kind of like a jackass the entire time. But I feel like I haven't seen him in anything.
No, he's in very few things, but I think as I recall hearing one time, and maybe this isn't even the right actor, but I believe he, after Mad Men, stepped back because he just, it didn't seem for him. I mean, doing right? 7 seasons of a show where you just play a prick can probably be a little overwhelming and a little demanding emotionally.
Yeah.
I believe he just really doesn't dig doing the whole acting thing 24/7.
So sure.
Maybe I heard that about somebody else, but I'm pretty sure it's that character. But I was expecting, I remember bits and pieces because this is my first rewatch. I only watched the series as it came out. I think season 3 or 4, I got into Mad Men and, you know, binged the first couple seasons and then watched it straight through until the series finale. Have not watched a second of it since. And then I caught some clips on YouTube the other day and I was like, you know what? I'm going to fucking watch this thing. And I remember early episodes of like Peggy getting pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Pete's dad dying in an airplane crash.
Oh, yeah. That kind of sucked.
And then I remembered the big speech of Don to Peggy when she's in the hospital, like, you will never believe how quickly this will have never happened. And I remembered that and I was like, okay, so Peggy's going to get pregnant pretty quick. That happens. And then I'm pretty sure season 1 ends with Don making that speech.
Yes.
And then they go into the... No, that's the 5th episode of the 2nd season.
Oh, no way.
So, yeah. So there's even more room to breathe. So I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And I thought, like, I knew Pete opened up as kind of a pig. But I thought, like, with the plane crashing, they tried to make you, like, sympathize with him.
Right.
But, like, the plane crashes and he's like, I
You're
don't
bitch,
even
Mom.
Feel anything.
Yeah.
And Pete, from the get-go, is the piece of shit, garbage, opportunistic asshole that he is for all 7 seasons.
Yeah.
There is no character development for him.
No.
He is just that guy. And that's a credit to the writing, is that they knew who these characters were. So when we get dropped in, they don't change over time. No, they're already who they are.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to just see like how much of what I remember of the later seasons is absolutely foundational to season 1 and 2.
I might go back and watch then.
It is.
If I have time before Obi-Wan.
Yeah. It is a time commitment, and I'm allowing myself to just piecemeal like episode here, episode there.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, you get through two episodes and there's a big cliffhanger and you're like, ah, oh, fuck. But I tell you what makes the rewatch easier is that it doesn't have AMC doing the insane, like, next time on Mad Men.
What?
How? He heard about that? Not again. What are we going to tell Don? There was just 30 seconds straight of just out of context clips that sounded like the most dramatic thing ever. And they never had anything to do with the plot. They were the single greatest episode on the next episode of whatever of all time. Because they didn't mean anything, but they were like, oh, I want to watch that episode right now.
Ugh. Do you remember? I'm sure this is still around. I'm pulling it up. Yeah, it's still around. During the original run, there was a novelty Twitter account called 80s Don Draper, where it was just...
remember this.
You should go find it while you're watching this. It's all like Don Draper style pitches of like 80s products.
Speaking of Annie being on Community or what's her bucket? Allison Brie being on Community, there's a scene where she gets swooned by Ahmed because... All right, do your best, Don Draper. And he just goes, cigarettes.
We spend our lives hunting ducks, terrified to face the giggling dog of failure. No one goes to Miami for the virtue. Deep it's within true. All of us, there's a baby on board.
Yeah, that's some good stuff.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Donkey Kong Jr. will repeat all the same mistakes his father did. To save Dance, first we must break it. I can hear this in a pitch meeting. You had me at Dungeons, you lost me at Dragons. all right, this is the rest of my night. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so... I'm very much enjoying Mad Men. How about you? Anything else other than your Disney deep dive that going on in your life?
Aside from Ukraine, which we don't have to talk about.
We really, really don't. Yeah, no. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
It's a bummer. But I think you and I solved it the other night over some drinks. Right. So everything's going to be fine.
Right.
All right. Well, next week, we're, of course, going to see The Batman.
Batman.
So that will be our discussion next weekend. Give you a prescient and timely, unlike most of our podcasts, review of some movies that are actually coming out again.
Yeah, that'll be cool. That's in the theater.
All right. For those of you listening along, head on over to subjecttoblackout.com to reach out to us, where you can find links to our socials, including Instagram, Patreon, Twitch, Twitter, and YouTube. You can also feel free to rate, review, and subscribe. And lastly, you can find Mike on Instagram and Twitter at Name Taken Podcast. Mike, want to thank you for joining me.
Cheers, Sam.
Yeah, man.